so why don't you guys buckle up and join the ride because we're going to have some fun going green.
And Abby said, you shouldn't commit illegal acts, except perhaps at night and with your parents' permission.
Your advice is making less sense than usual.
Well, the important thing is family and friendship, honesty, values, and no one got arrested.
You see this jerk? This is the same thing. Kropotkin was the same jerk, and Bakunin was the same jerk. Not good. Not good, I'm telling you.
He was a very good dancer.
He's a low-life.
George Orwell, who definitely didn't like socialism of any kind, warned us against this. He wrote books that said that totalitarianism is bad and that sticking with old ideas is good.
I got news for you. You gotcha. Did you know the population again?
I did not know that.
I never thought you'd lose a Stalin debate.
You never expect to walk into one.
Sure.
Avoid Marxism. Or telling her you're a Trotskyite.
Trotskyist. Only Stalinists would call the Trotskyist a Trotskyite. And I'm not a Trotskyist anymore. I'm a Maoist.
Relentlessly anti-Trump and relentlessly pro somebody like Obama.
I'm not pro-Obama. I've been a critic of Obama. I'm a critic of the Democratic Party. Because I'm literally a communist.
Well, you know how it is. The main thing is to get those juicy likes and subscribes. And we can get some more of that sweet, sweet communist money rolling in. You know how it is, bro. Gotta get the communist dollar, gotta make it to the top.
Just imagine somebody saying under cannibalism or under slavery or under dictatorship, well, there's nothing you can do about it. Well, they'd be wrong. There is something you can do about it. You can get beyond these archaic systems and move closer and closer to fulfilling human capacities. And that's what we need to do.
Welcome, welcome to the Three Left Show. I'm your host, Dan Platt, live in the studio. Here on a live edition of the Three Left Show, this show is about going in a different direction. If your intro didn't clue you in, this is a leftist reading hour with a bit of humor, trying to do a little sing-song voice, maybe a little more. This show is about exploring post-capitalism, leftism with issues, theory, practice. What do we do to solve the big issues, asking the big questions for the curious or the committed? Because as a leftist myself and listener of podcasts and other media, I found that there was a niche missing of a show that covered many different perspectives at once, but all of these perspectives are then reframed and packaged together in some kind of cohesive whole of some kind. In an ongoing conversation where no point is made in an absolute way, I can always revisit things. But this episode is actually about reacting to climate change. I've made a few episodes over the summer about this already, talking about hope and not policy yet. That's actually, that'll probably be the next one, actual concrete policies. What's the plan, right? But of course, the plan is to actually let democracy reign and socialize. But first, talking about climate change response and the crisis, and just societal crises in general. Not just, let's say it's not the climate, but let's say it's economic. They go hand in hand. So, ultimate preface to everything I'm going to be reading in the next 2 hours, more or less, is there is no, maybe you've heard this before, maybe you haven't, there is no such thing as ethical consumption under capitalism. Right? In our economic system, all labor is exploited, all nature is exploited, and everything made, no matter how what kind of green packaging it is, it's all part of a value-extracting process that takes value out of nature, out of labor, and siphons it up to the top. That is the natural, that is what is incentivized. No one operating in it is, quote-unquote, a bad person. They're doing what they're incentivized to do. That is why, to me, it's a very natural position to just be anti-capitalist or for a post-capitalist economy that does not depend on the profit motive and the incentive structure. And this does not entail reforms at the margins. Even Bernie Sanders-type reforms is still nibbling at the margins of the problem. Even if we have massive unionization, the main social democrat argument is that unions allow workers to buy more. But we actually, the only actual ethical act is to buy less. There is no ethical consumption. There's no amount of green packaging. It is buy less, work less. Be lazy. That's true resistance. You want to resist the government? You want to resist big corporations? Don't feed them with your labor. Because whether it's labor that produces tax income or profit, it's not participating in the corrupt, terrible system that's destroying the planet. So let's start with the longest article I have. I'll get it out of the way. From the New Yorker. That's why it's longer. New Yorker publishes longer stuff. This is from the cultural comments section. It's called, What If We Stop Pretending? The climate apocalypse is coming. So it takes that as a granted. To prepare for it, we need to admit that we can't prevent it. So this is by Jonathan Frazen. So he starts with a Kafka quote. Kafka himself read as commenting on the absurdity of modern times, but better, you know, a left-wing perspective would read it as a critique of capitalist economics. For example, in his major book, Metamorphosis, you know, the guy wakes up as a cockroach. His main concern is still going to work because, like, he has to pay rent. And that's supposed to be, like, it's supposed to be seen as, it's usually read by, you know, in high school that it's absurd. It's like, but why is it absurd? That he has to keep earning money. He has to go to his job. Yeah, okay. So there's infinite hope, Kafka tells us, only not for us. This is a fittingly mystical anagram for a writer whose characters strive for ostensibly reachable goals and tragically or amusingly never manage to get any closer to them. But it seems to me, in our rapidly darkening world, that the converse of Kafka's quip is equally true. There is no hope except for us. I'm talking, of course, about climate change. The struggle to rein in global carbon emissions and keep the planet from melting down has the feel of Kafka's fiction. The goal has been clear for 30 years. I dispute that. Not clear as far as the science is concerned, but politically and in our consciousness, it's been clear. It's been clear in the minds of those looking at the issue. So in that case, just as anti-capitalism is very clear to me, it isn't so much to others. That's what this program is about. Today, the scientific evidence verges on irrefutable. If you're younger than 60, you have a good chance of witnessing the radical destabilization of life on Earth, which includes massive crop failures, apocalyptic fires, imploding economies, epic flooding, hundreds of millions of refugees fleeing regions made uninhabitable by extreme heat or permanent drought. If you're under 30, you're all but guaranteed to witness it. If you care about the planet and about the people and animals who live on it, there are two ways to think about this. Now, you can keep on hoping that catastrophe is preventable and feel even more frustrated or enraged by our political system's inaction, or you can accept that disaster is coming and begin to rethink what it means to have hope about it. Even at this late date, expressions of unrealistic hope continue to abound. Hardly a day seems to pass without my reading that it's time to roll up our sleeves and save the planet, as if it's just a matter of, you know, going to a job. That the problem of climate change can be solved, quote-unquote, if we summon the collective will, as if collective will can even be expressed in our political system, which it can't. Only through mass protest and mass action and civil disobedience is popular will expressed. Not for the ballot box. Anyway, although the message was probably still true in 88, when the science became more clear, we've emitted as much atmospheric carbon in the past 30 years as we did in the previous two centuries. Facts have changed, but somehow the message stays the same. You know, that's the thing about late capitalism. Everything, this is a Chapo quote, Chapo Trap House, everything's always getting worse, but everything's staying the same. Psychologically, this denial makes sense. Despite the outrageous fact that I'll soon be dead forever, I live in the present, not the future. Given a choice between alarming abstraction, death, and the reassuring evidence of my senses, breakfast, my mind prefers to focus on the latter. The planet, too, is still marvelously intact, still basically normal. Seasons change, another election year is coming, new economies on Netflix. And its impending collapse is even harder to wrap my mind around than death. Ooh. Other kinds of apocalypse, whether religious or thermonuclear or asteroid-based, at least have the binary neatness of dying. One moment, the world's here, and the next it's not. Climate apocalypse, by contrast, is messy. It will take the form of increasingly severe crises, compounding chaotically until civilization begins to fray, first at the edges, until it reaches the core. Things will get very bad, but maybe not too soon. Maybe not for everyone, particularly the poor first. Maybe not for me. Some of the denial, and this is speaking as a New Yorker writer, probably not. The crisis will hit New York City last. That is the core of our empire, and the core always goes last. Usually in some spectacular sacking. Some of the denial, however, is more willful. The evil of the Republican Party's position on climate science is well known, but denial is entrenched in progressive politics, too. The Green New Deal, scare quotes, the Dem Party one, the blueprint for some of the most substantial proposals to put forth on the issue, is still framed as our last chance to avert catastrophe and save the planet by way of gargantuan renewable energy projects. Many of these groups that support those proposals deploy the language of stopping climate change, or imply that there is still time to prevent it. Unlike the political right, the left prides itself on listening to climate scientists, who do indeed allow that catastrophe is theoretically avertible, but not everyone seems to be listening that carefully. The stress falls on the word theoretically. Our atmosphere and oceans can absorb only so much heat before climate change, intensified by various feedback loops, spins out of control. The consensus among scientists and policymakers, useful as they are, eye roll, is that we'll pass this point of no return if the global mean temperature rises more than 2 degrees. The International Panel on Climate Change tells us to limit that rise, we need to reverse the trend of the past 3 decades. We need to approach zero emissions in the next 30 years. So I've commented that many cities and countries have this 80% reduction by 2050. We need to be at zero by 2050. And that's being conservative. This is, to say the least, a tall order. It also assumes that you trust the calculations. New research described last month in Scientific American demonstrates that climate scientists, far from exaggerating the threat of climate change, have underestimated its pace and severity, which is a trend. To project the rise in global mean temperature, scientists rely on a complicated atmospheric modeling paradigm. They take a host of variables and run them through supercomputers to generate, say, 10,000 different simulations for the coming century in order to make the best prediction of the rise of temperature. When a scientist predicts a rise of 2 degrees Celsius, she's merely naming a number about which she's very confident. The rise will be at least 2 degrees. The rise might, in fact, be far higher. As a non-scientist, I do my own kind of modeling. I run various future scenarios through my brain, apply the constraints of human psychology and political reality, living in a calcified, inertia-filled empire, take note of the relentless rise on global energy consumption. Thus far, the carbon savings provided by renewable energy have been more than offset by consumer demand, right? We live in a growth-based economy. We have to keep growing, even if it's all renewable energy. And count the scenarios in which collective action averts catastrophe. The scenarios which I draw from the prescriptions of policymakers and activists share certain necessary conditions. Hopefully I'm not reading too fast. The first condition is that every one of the world's major polluting countries institute draconian conservative measures. They shut down most of its energy and he's going in the last paragraph here, just kind of ending with the prescriptive side, but not really that. Okay. So here's the factors at play. It seems like the only thing we could do to meet any of these goals, to actually say stop or slow ecosystem collapse via climate change. So the first condition to do that is that every one of the world's major polluting countries, modern, first world, second world ones, institute draconian, meaning top-down authoritarian, conservation measures. Shut down most of its energy and transportation infrastructure, and completely retool its economy. According to a recent paper in Nature, the carbon emissions from existing global infrastructure, if operated through its normal lifetime, right? So say a highway is built to last for 30 years, and there are highways being built today with the expectation that they will last. And same with, say, gas power plants. They have a life of 40 years. That means the expectation that we're going to keep burning gas, frack gas, past 2050. How are we going to go to zero if we're still investing in fossil fuel infrastructure, still building it today? That is why it needs to be opposed in every conceivable way. Carbon emissions from existing global infrastructure, if operated for its normal lifetime, will exceed our entire emissions, quote-unquote, allowance, the further gigatons of carbon can be released without crossing the threshold of catastrophe. Aside, this estimate does not include the thousands of new energy and transportation projects already planned. To stay within that allowance, a top-down intervention needs to happen not only in every country, but throughout every country. Making New York City a green utopia will not avail if Texans keep pumping oil and driving pickup trucks. The actions taken by these countries must also be the right ones. Vast sums of government money must be spent without wasting it, without lining the wrong pockets. Here, it's useful to recall another Kafka-esque joke of the European Union's biofuel mandate, which served to accelerate the deforestation of Indonesia for palm oil plantations, and the American subsidy of ethanol fuel, which turned out to benefit no one but some corn farmers. Finally, overwhelming numbers of human beings, including millions of government-hating Americans, need to accept high taxes and severe curtailment of their familiar lifestyles without revolting. They must accept the reality of climate change and have faith in the extreme measures taken to combat it. They can't dismiss news they dislike as fake. They have to set aside nationalism, which is a big ask, and class and racial resentments. They have to make sacrifices for distant threatened nations and distant future generations their own. They have to be permanently terrified by hotter summers and more frequent natural disasters rather than just getting used to them, which I think is what everyone's really prepared to do. Every day, instead of thinking about breakfast, they have to think about death. Call me a pessimist or humanist, but I don't see human nature fundamentally changing anytime soon. The incentive structure isn't, anyway. I can run 10,000 scenarios through my model, and if not one of them, I do see a 2-degree target being met. But that's just the one privileged writer speaking. To judge from recent opinion polls, which show that a majority of Americans, many of them Republican, are pessimistic about the planet's future, and from the success of a book like David Wallace Wells' Harrowing, The Uninhabitable Earth, which was released this year, I'm not alone in having reached this conclusion. But there continues to be a reluctance to broadcast it. Some climate activists argue that if we publicly admit that the problem can't be solved, it will discourage people from taking any action at all. That explains why, say, progressive Democrats will talk like Green New Deal, their Green New Deal can stop climate change. Because people, at least the marketing tells us, that people react better to certainties. This product will grow your hair back. Not maybe. Okay, this seems to me not only a patronizing calculation, yes, but an ineffectual one, given how little progress we have to show for it to date. Now, similarly ineffective is hiding your actual opinions and ideology. It's like, oh, no, socialism is unpopular. People get triggered by the word. We shouldn't use it. And then Bernie Sanders started actually using it on a national stage. And now suddenly every left winger I admire that you wouldn't use it in the last 20 years now is comfortable using it. And they'll admit that they have Bernie Sanders to thank. The activists who make this case remind me of religious leaders who fear that without the promise of eternal salvation, people won't bother to behave well. Now, in my experience, speaking as a positive atheist myself, non-believers are no less loving than their neighbors or than believers are. And so I wonder what might happen if, instead of denying reality, we told ourselves the truth. First of all, even if we can no longer hope to be saved from 2 degrees of warming, there's still a strong practical and ethical case for reducing carbon emissions. In the long run, it makes no difference how badly we overshoot 2 degrees. Once the point of no return is passed, the world will become self-transforming. In the shorter term, so we're going to have to transform whether it's a conscious decision or not. In the shorter term, however, half measures are better than no measures. Halfway cutting our emissions would make the intermediate effects of warming somewhat less severe, and it would somewhat postpone the point of no return. The most terrifying thing about climate change is the speed at which it's advancing. The almost monthly shattering of temperature records, if not in America, but elsewhere in the world, If collective action resulted in just one fewer devastating hurricane, just a few extra years of relative stability, it would be a goal worth pursuing. Now, this paragraph itself was, to me, my teenage self, which was 05, 06, the argument that got me on the we should take action against climate change in big ways mindset. You know, I was like skeptical, you know, teenager, like I'm not sure what I believe yet. My brain's not fully formed. But it was the argument of, well, even if there's no climate change, right, and there's no crisis, it's still better to have a non-pollution economy, you know, not a less polluting economy, one that's more equitable, and everything else that a Green New Deal or large sweeping climate policy would accomplish. And yes, as far as right-wingers say, yes, it is to accomplish a lot of progressively left-wing economic or left-leaning economic policy, because conservative policy ain't doing a goddamn thing. Okay. In fact, it would be worth pursuing even if it had no effect at all to fail to conserve a finite resource when conservation measures are available to needlessly add carbon to the atmosphere when we know very well what it's doing is simply wrong. Although the actions of one individual have zero effect on this, this doesn't mean that they're meaningless. Each of us has an ethical choice to make. During the Protestant Reformation, he's going way back in time, when the end times were merely an idea, not the horribly concrete thing it is today, a key doctrinal question was whether you should perform good works because it will get you into heaven, or whether you should perform them simply because they're good. Because while heaven is a question mark, you know that this world would be better if everyone performed them. I can respect the planet and care about the people with whom I share it without believing that will save me. More than that, a false hope of salvation can be actively harmful. If you persist in believing that catastrophe can be averted, you commit yourself to tackling a problem so immense that it needs to be everyone's overriding priority forever. One result, weirdly, is a kind of complacency. By voting for quote-unquote green candidates, I don't think he's referring to Green Party candidates, just green candidates, because again, this is, I usually end reading such an article by saying this is all capitalist realism. Like, there's no alternative to capitalism. There's no even question about this. Like, he doesn't mention we need a different economic system. He's just saying, like, it would just, when he says the economy would need to be retooled, he's talking about carbon taxes. And just changing tax policy is not changing the economy, whatever you've been told. Okay, so when he says green candidates, I think he just means green talking candidates, green wash candidates. And then he goes, another example, riding a bike to work, avoiding air travel, which I've talked about. You might feel that you've done everything you can for the only thing worth doing. Whereas, if you accept the reality that the planet will soon overheat to the point of threatening our civilization, there's a whole lot more you could be doing, should be doing. Because our resources aren't infinite. Even if we invest much of them in a longest shot gamble, reducing carbon emissions in the hope that it will save us, it's unwise to invest all of them. Every $1 billion spent on high-speed trains, which may or may not be suitable for North America, I totally disagree with that statement. We can totally have high-speed trains in America. It just means it takes 2 days to cross the country instead of half a day. But it's still way faster than whatever else. Having been someone who's taken the train for 2 days, which may or may not be okay. If $1 billion not banked for disaster preparedness, reparations for inundated countries, future humanitarian relief, every renewable energy mega project that destroys a living ecosystem, the green development, energy development now occurring in Kenya's national parks, the giant hydroelectric projects in Brazil, the construction of solar farms in open space rather than settled areas. This erodes, all of these things erode the resilience of a natural world already fighting for its life. Soil and water depletion, overuse of pesticides, devastation of fisheries. Collective will is needed for these problems too. And unlike the problem of carbon, just to focus on that one thing, all of these things are within our power to solve. As a bonus, many low-tech conservation actions, like restoring forests, preserving grasslands, eating less meat, can reduce our carbon footprint as effectively as these massive industrial changes. Now, of course, these state, again, it's part of the status quo type thinking that to eat less meat, to actually consume less, is a massive industrial change. More on that later. There may come a time sooner than any of us likes to think when the systems of industrial agriculture and global trade break down and homeless people outnumber the people with homes. Of course, how would that happen? If the other stuff breaks down, the banking system that owns the homes and mortgages to buy homes, that breaks down too. So I don't think it'll matter who owns homes, who has the deed. At that point, traditional local farming and strong communities will no longer just be liberal buzzwords. Kindness to neighbors and respect for the land, nurturing healthy soil, wisely managing water, caring for pollinators, will be essential in a crisis in whatever society survives it. A project like the Homeless Garden offers me the hope that the future will undoubtedly be worse than the present, might also in some ways be better. Most of all, through it gives me hope for today. So, Jonathan Frazen here is the author of a novel called Purity. But a novel. Oh, and he talks about, the paragraphs I skipped, he talks about the Homeless Garden Project in Santa Cruz, where the homeless population is given something to do, which of course doesn't solve their homelessness, but it allows them to earn a little income. They grow food in these community gardens that gets sold. And this writer, is a member of its CSA, that's Community Supported Agriculture Program. So basically you pay in a subscription, and part of that subscription goes to the homeless working the garden, so at least they're not completely broke. Okay. I think that ending paragraph there wants, I think I want to do this really short one. I study collapsed civilization. Here's my advice for a climate change apocalypse. This is from the Lexington Herald Leader in Kentucky. The story was shared via the Solarpunk Anarchist page, or one of the Solarpunk pages on Facebook that I'm a member of. So this is the guy is writing, but Chris Berkeley. I'm an archaeologist and a wilderness survival instructor. Because I study societies that have collapsed, and since I teach basic outdoor skills, people ask me about what to do in a natural disaster, social upheaval, or some other apocalyptic event. Right now, much of that concern relates to climate change, what I would do, where I would go, and what equipment I would take. Now, in our media, this might be expressed as zombie apocalypse. Now, I understand the preoccupation with things falling apart. We face serious problems like climate change. Perhaps because we worry, we envision the post-apocalyptic world. However, the great number of zombie fantasies and natural disaster movies suggest more than just a concern for the future. We seem to enjoy the fantasy. We like imagining life after civilization collapses. You know, we don't have to go to a job. Like wiggling a two-loose, it hurts in a good way. I understand the appeal of these post-apocalyptic fantasies. They resonate with the rugged individualism and self-sufficiency that we imagine ourselves to have. In the post-apocalypse, we would be able to start over from a blank slate, decluttering on a global scale. Our needs would be immediate and our focuses would be clear. The tasks might be hard, but decisions would be easy. Life would be simple. As a survival instructor, I can teach you the skills we think would be important. These are relatively simple. Starting fires, shelter building, direction finding, and even picking locks. We can learn all the cool stuff from the movies. Armed with that knowledge, we imagine ourselves heading out to the woods with our families, with our chosen clan, surviving on our own. We will be self-sufficient. We can get back to basics. Surely these types of forgotten outdoor skills will allow us to negotiate the collapse brought by climate collapse, change, neoliberalism, other types of authoritarianism, zombies, or media, right? Wrong. As an anthropologist who studies human societies, I know this is not how it plays out. An apocalyptic disaster will be nothing like those fantasies. It will be harder than we think, and we will need different talents than the survival skills I teach. I study how people live and how societies change in the past and the present. I cannot predict this future, obviously, but no likely disaster scenario fits any of our current fantasies. No tragic and convenient event will allow us to discard our complex, messy, and ever-changing society, social reality, and live out our rugged individualistic fantasy. We will not be by ourselves, with only the people of our choosing, avoiding those we do not understand or trust. We will not be free from the need to cooperate and compromise. Any of the plausible scenarios for disaster, like an unchecked climate collapse, and I keep using climate collapse, unchecked eco-collapse, let's call it that. It will involve billions of survivors. We will find ourselves in large groups in rapidly changing situations, and we will have to negotiate that. We will not escape the messiness of contemporary society, because it's, you know, the fantasies depend on massive die-off, which is a type of eugenics or something. Let's see. Any post-apocalyptic reality will not be a time machine to a mythical past that we may long for. It will not be a simpler, uncluttered life. We will not be able to run away. We will have to stay and fix things. And if we succeed, we may not recognize ourselves. While the wilderness survival skills certainly can't hurt, it will be empathy, generosity, and courage that will be needed to survive. Kindness and fairness will be more valuable than any survival skill. Then, as now, social and leadership skills will be valued. We'll have to work together. That is why I myself put a lot of time into facilitation and meetings, because making decisions in groups of various sizes to me is really, really freaking important. And the ability to lead such decision-making powwows and such, I feel like will be in high demand. It kind of is now. I kind of need to sell that, but it's more of work, and I want to work less. Anyway, last bit. We'll have to grow food, educate ourselves, and give people a reason to persevere. So no more professionals, or at least less dependence on them. The needs will be enormous, and we cannot run away from that. Humans evolved attributes such as generosity, altruism, and cooperation because we need them to survive. That is a human nature I concentrate on. Armed with those skills, we will turn towards the problem, not away from it. We'll face the need, and we'll solve it together is the only option. That's what survival looks like. So this man, Chris Burgley, is also the director of the Exploration Foundation, a National Geographic Explorer, professor of anthropology in Transylvania University. But he's writing from Kentucky, so I'm guessing Transylvania is a town in Kentucky, or it's the name of a university in Kentucky. Okay, good. Just a little more time for the kind of trifecta on the topic. Now from a more humorous point of view, via The Independent. Now for a word from Uncle Zizek, Slavo Zizek. Love this guy. So he wrote a piece, and this was during the height, perhaps they're still going, Amazon Rainforest Fires. So it's titled, this one is anyway, Yes, It Is a Climate Crisis, and Your Tiny Human Efforts Have Never Seemed So Meager. So if you don't know Slavo Zizek, he is a Marxist, but not quite Marxist, a Hegelian, he would call himself, philosopher. He's written dozens of books, prolific speaker, makes entertaining videos, and similar to my opening premise that the best thing we can do for the climate and ourselves is to work and consume less. I do have a clip of him in one of my intros. But he says, like, the point of Occupy and our mass movements today is to not participate in their broken system, to say no. I would prefer not to work 50 hours. I would prefer to bum around, because you can morally judge someone, horribly morally judge someone for, say, being lazy, a bum, homeless, whatever. They're not putting in the 120%. But guess what? They're living more ethically than you are, because they're not buying sweatshop shit. They're not contributing to the climate crisis. They're not contributing to anything at all, which, in fact, is a kind of very zen thing, that sometimes the best action is no action. Starting from, and he also has a very heavy accent. He has kind of social problems where he kind of does this thing with his shirt and sniffs his nose all the time. I won't do that. I don't need to do an impression. But I will kind of exaggerate my voice somehow. Talk of a climate crisis moves to the top of the agenda again, just as burning the Amazon forest drifts from our headlines. But are we really heading towards a collective suicide? We instinctively feel that by destroying the Amazon rainforest, Brazilians are killing the lungs of our earth. However, if we want to confront seriously threats to our environment, what we should avoid are precisely the Schutzer's quick extrapolations which fascinate our imagination, like those post-apocalyptic fantasies, right? 2 or 3 decades ago, everyone in Europe was talking about Waldsterben, the dying of forests. The topic was on the covers of all popular weeklies, and there were calculations on how in half a century Europe will be without forests. Now there are more forests in Europe than at any point in the 20th century, and we are becoming aware of other dangers, of what happens in the depth of the ocean, for example. Now, of course, it sounds like he's saying these problems seem to solve themselves, or the media made a big problem of something and it turned out not to be a problem. But that's neglecting that the coverage of a problem allowed people to be informed about it and do something to prevent it. People cared about conserving forests and planting new forests, so now there's more forests in Europe than there were in, say, after the world wars, which did a lot to destroy them. While we should take ecological threats extremely seriously, we should also be fully aware of how uncertain analyses and projections are in this domain. We will know for sure what is going on only when it is too late. Fast extrapolations only hand arguments to climate change deniers. We should avoid at all costs the trap of an ecology of fear, a hasty, morbid fascination with looming catastrophe. This ecology of fear, as he's calling it, has the hallmarks of a developing predominant form of ideology in global capitalism. A new opium for the masses, you may say, replacing the declining of religion. It takes over the old religion's fundamental function, that of installing an unquestionable authority which can impose limits. Now, I want to say aside that there are many writers talking about what is replacing religion as it declines. I would say that new dogmas are very similar to the old dogmas. So it's really not it's the text, you know, the content has changed a little bit. But as far as the mindset, the dogma is, it's still there, right? So the real change is being non-dogmatic, which Zizek fits to me. Because he's always kind of, as he says, like, you know, this is important, but this. He's constantly doing that. The lesson hammered into us is that of our own finitude. We are just one species on our Earth embedded in a biosphere which reaches far beyond our horizon. In our exploitation of natural resources, we are borrowing from the future. So one should treat our Earth with respect as something ultimately sacred, something that should not be unveiled totally, that should and will forever remain a mystery, a power we should trust, not dominate. While we cannot gain full mastery over our biosphere, it is unfortunately in our power to derail it, to disturb its balance so that it will run amok, swiping us away in the process. This is why, although ecologists are all the time demanding that we make radical changes to our way of life, underlying this demand is its opposite, a deep distrust of change, of development, of progress. Every radical change can have the unintended consequence of catastrophe itself. As well. Things get even more difficult here. Even when we profess the readiness to assume responsibility for the ecological catastrophe, this can be a tricky stratagem to avoid facing the true scale of the threat. There is something deceptively reassuring in this readiness to assume the guilt for threats to our environment. We like to be guilty, since if we are guilty, then it all depends on us. We pull the strings of the catastrophe. we're still in control. So we can also save ourselves simply by changing our lives and still, you know, maintaining of control. What is, or a sense of control? What is really difficult for us, at least for us in the West, to accept is that we might be reduced to a purely passive role of impotent observers who can only sit and watch our fate play out. To avoid this, we are prone to engage in frantic activity. We recycle old paper. We buy organic food. Whatever. Just so that we can be sure we are doing something, making our contribution. But he compares this. We are like a soccer fan who supports his team in front of a TV screen at home, shouting and jumping from his seat in a superstitious belief that this will somehow influence the outcome. It is true that the typical form of fetishist disavowal around ecology is, I know very well that we are all threatened, but I don't really believe it, so I am not ready to do anything important like changing my way of life. But there is also the opposite form of this disavowal. I know very well that I cannot really influence the process which can lead to my ruin, like a volcano, but it is nonetheless too traumatic for me to accept this, so I cannot resist the urge to do something, even if I know it is ultimately meaningless. So, is it not for that reason we buy organic food? Who really believes that the half-rotten and expensive organic apples are really healthier? The point is that by way of buying them, we do not just buy and consume a product, we simultaneously do something meaningful to show we care about the environment or ourselves or the or global awareness. We participate in this large collective project, you know, of mass consumption, which in turn fuels ecocide. The predominant ecological ideology treats us as a priori guilty, indebted to Mother Nature, under the constant pressure of an ecological superego agency which addresses us in our individuality. Quoting, what did you do today to repay your debt to nature? Did you put all your newspapers in a proper recycling bin? And all the bottles of beer or your cans of Coke? Did you use your bike or public transport instead of a car? Did you open windows wide rather than firing up the air conditioning? The ideological stakes of such individualization, you know, just focusing on what you're doing, are easy to see. I get lost in my own self-examination, you know, looking at what you're doing, being internal, instead of raising much more pertinent global questions about our entire civilization, you know, the one that or is under threat. Ecology thus lends itself easily to ideological mystification. You know, we can't really know, man. It can be a pretext for New Age obscuration, the praising for the pre-modern, or a type of neocolonialism, which comes in the form of the developed world complaining of the threat of rapid growth in developing countries like Brazil or China, or as a cause to honor green capitalists, you know, buying green and recycling, as if taking into account ecology justifies capitalist exploitation. All of these tensions explode in our reactions to the recent Amazon fires. So many less out that there are five main strategies to distract from the true dimensions of the ecological threat. You know, that's societal, it's the structural level, not an individual one. First, there is simple ignorance. It's a marginal phenomenon, not worthy of our preoccupation. Life goes on, nature will take care of itself. The second, there is a belief that science and technology can save us. You know, there will be a techno fix. Third, that we should leave the solution to the market, you know, by taxing polluters. Fourth, distraction. We resort to the superego pressure on personal responsibility instead of large systemic measures that each of us should recycle, consume less, etc. You know, so I'm pushing that. So maybe I'm just distracting you. The fifth distraction is perhaps the worst, is the advocating of a return to natural balance, to a more modest, traditional life by means of which we renounce human hubris and become again respectful children of our mother nature, which comes in the form of regressive or reactionary forms of eco-fascism or talk of eugenics, stuff like we need to control the population, we need to reduce birth rates. It's all quite horrible if you actually examine not only the ideas themselves, but the source of those Malthusian ideas. Malthus being the originator, was a horrible, noble, class, racist person centuries ago. So, you know, normal for being an upper class gent. But, you know, the kind of guy who says the Irish should just kill all their children rather than say maybe stop exporting all of their grain. This whole paradigm of Mother Nature derailed by our hubris is wrong. The fact that our main sources of energy, oil and coal, are remnants of past catastrophes which occurred prior to the advent of humanity is a clear reminder that Mother Nature is cold and cruel. This, of course, is no way means that we should relax and trust our future. The fact that it is not clear what is going on makes the situation even more dangerous. Plus, as it is fast becoming evident, migrations, and the walls meant to prevent them, are getting more and more intertwined with ecological disturbances like global warming, the ecological apocalypse, and the refugees apocalypse are more and more overlapping in what Philip Aston, a UN special reporter, described entirely accurately. Quoting Philip Aston, "We risk a climate apartheid scenario, where the wealthy pay to escape overheating, hunger, and conflict, while the rest of the world is left to suffer." Going back to Zizek, the least responsible for global emissions also have the least capacity to protect themselves. So, the Leninist quick question, what is to be done? We are in a deep mess. There is no simple democratic solution here. The idea that people themselves, not just governments and corporations, should decide sounds deep, but it begs an important question. You know, it's basically what NPR does in nauseam. It's like, we'll just let people decide. But it begs an important question. Even if their comprehension is not distorted by corporate interests, profit-making, etc., self-interested things, what qualifies them to pass judgment in such a delicate manner? What we can do is at least set the priorities straight and admit the absurdity of our geopolitical war games when the very planet for which wars are fought is under threat. In the Amazon, we see a ridiculous game of Europe blaming Brazil and Brazil blaming Europe. It has to stop. Ecological threats make it clear, and by the way, this is because the Amazon's burning for meat production. It's Europe and China buying the meat. So it's then becomes cyclical blame and guilt. But this has to stop. Ecological threats make it clear that the era of sovereign nation states is approaching its end. A strong global agency is needed with the power to coordinate the necessary measures. And does such the need for such an agency point in the direction of what was once called communism? And he ends with that because that's just the way Zizek rolls. So, but context for what he's saying, because he doesn't give it, is that in a internationalist, you know, leftist paradigm that, you know, say if all the world's governments are left-leaning and that there's no longer competition between superpowers or middle powers or just other, you know, nation states are like, in some ways conservatives are right, they're like big companies and they're competing with other big companies for markets and resources, and this leads to war and suffering and so on. And so it's the leftist internationalist position that countries stop competing and start coordinating trade and resource use with each other. And this would be a quote-unquote one world government, because like the UN, but with power and responsibility and some democratic decision-making power, which currently doesn't have at all. We don't, Well, yeah, you know, our UN delegates are appointed by who we elect. But of course, that's all very much strained logic. Most of us don't elect who's president. Welcome, welcome back to the Three Left Show, your leftist reading hour. This show's for the curious or the committed. This episode, I am talking about continuing conversations reacting to climate catastrophe. And what does it really take to, quote unquote, save the planet, save ourselves, save our society, as people worry about the and argue about the Democratic primary as if it's all hinging on who's president. I assure you, it isn't. I'm going to assert that. Am I going to back it up? Well, here and there. But mainly the argument this episode is there is no ethical consumption under capitalism. The best thing you can do, and I'm not speaking personally here, but it's part of it, is to consume and work less. As that is what is accelerating things in our growth economy. So, to work off of that, I have a Guardian piece, an interview with Václav Smil, if I'm saying it right. This interview was conducted by Jonathan Watts, the scientist and author, on his latest book, an epic multidisciplinary analysis of growth and why humanity's endless expansion must stop. Now, of course, is he talking about just growth in the economy or growth of humanity? It's a bit of both. So the capitalist realism, the there is no alternative, is very strong in this piece. And I'll make some snide remarks when finished, because it ends with a particularly juicy little morsel that I'm just going to meme off of. So, Václav Smil is a distinguished professor emeritus in the Faculty of Environment at the University of Manitoba in Winnipeg, Canada. Over more than 40 years, his books on the environment, population, food, and energy have steadily grown in influence. He is now seen as one of the world's foremost thinkers on development history and a master of statistical analysis. And his biggest fan is Bill Gates. His latest book is Growth from Microorganisms to Megacities. So the interviewer again is Watts. So I'll just say Watts says when he's speaking, and the Falkov when he's speaking. Watts, you are the nerd's nerd. There's perhaps no other academic who paints pictures with numbers like you. You dug up the astonishing statistic that China has poured more cement every 3 years since 2003 than the U.S. had in the entire 20th century. You calculated that in 2000, the dry mass of all the humans in the world was 125 million metric tons. Wow, that's so useful. Compared with just the 10 million tons for all wild vertebrates. And now you explore patterns of growth from the healthy development of forests and brains to the unhealthy increase in obesity and carbon dioxide in the atmosphere. Before we get into those deeper issues, can I ask if you see yourself as a nerd? So important. Not at all. I'm just an old-fashioned scientist describing the world and the lay of the land as it is. That's all there is to it, and it's not good enough just to say life is better or the trains are faster. You have to bring in the numbers. This book is an exercise in buttressing what I have to say with numbers, so people see that these are the facts, and they are difficult to dispute. So right off the bat, you kind of get into this technocratic mindset that the facts are the facts, numbers are what matters, what's valuable is what's measurable, even though there are many valuable things that are not measurable. I think it's an Einstein quote. There are valuable things that are unmeasurable. Everything that's measured isn't always valuable. And that kind of runs with everything with this book that I haven't read, but from how they talk about it, it's like he's just listing the facts and apparently deep conclusions about life and our direction as a society can be teased out. Without any structural analysis or looking at society itself, you know, the kinds of things that Zizek, who I just read, does, and what the next article I'm going to read, which will be a counter to this one, in a way, in multiple ways. Okay, back to Watts. Growth is a huge book, almost 200,000 words. More, that synthesize many of your other studies, ranging across the world and exploring far into the past and future. Do you see this as your magnum opus? Because the guy's kind of old. I've deliberately set out to write the mega book on growth. In a way, it's unwieldy and unreasonable. People can take any number of books out of it. Economists can read about the growth of GDP and population. Again, not questioning that GDP is a terrible indicator of economic success or viability or whatever. It's just measuring the number of transactions. You know, how much money is made, how much value is being extracted, not whether it's being used for general good. Anyway, biologists can read about the growth of organisms and human bodies, but I wanted to put it all together under one roof so people could see how these things are inevitably connected. And how it all shares one crystal clarity, that growth must come to an end. Our economist friends don't seem to realize that. Now, what I do, you know, that is what I agree with. Now, okay, this is actually particularly interesting. So, as I mentioned, Zizek is Czech, and so is this Vakhelv guy. I first came across your work while I was writing a book about the Chinese environment. Time and again, this is Watts, you had the data that I was looking for, and it often revealed how dubious many of the official stats were. You have been described as a slayer of bullshit. Is that your goal? He responds, I was brought up in Czechoslovakia during the era of the Soviet bloc. Having spent 26 years of my life in the evil empire, as he refers to it, I do not tolerate nonsense. I grew up surrounded by commie propaganda, the bright tomorrow, the great future of mankind. So it's as critical as they come. So I'm as critical as they come. It's not my opinion. These are the facts. I don't write opinion pieces. I write things that are totally underlined by facts. So Zizek, again, like I'm just pointing out that they grew up in the same environment, but they're completely different mindsets. Where this nerd, Zizek's a nerd too of the type, but I mean, he's just like, I just write the facts. I have no perspective. that's kind of what he's saying, that like, I don't have, it's like, it's not my opinion, man. You know, but even though if I agree with his conclusion, growth needs to end, I think how you come at it and why growth needs to end completely different. Okay. Watts asks, you debunk overly rosy projections by techno-optimists, you know, that science and tech will save us, who say we can solve all our problems with smarter computers, and economists who promise endless capitalist growth. All we have to do is have the right tax policy. All we have to do is have the right tax policy. In many countries, the downside of material growth now seems greater than the upside, which leads to what you call anthropogenic insults to ecosystems. Is that a fair summary? Now, before I get to Valkov's answer, I want to mention that, you know, these downsides to material growth is usually, it is a result of the inequality. That the growth, right, we you know, the economies grow, more is being extracted, more things are being made, but all the value is going to the top, right? So in summing this conversation, and what I mean by like it being status quo ideology or viewpoint, is that it's taking the economy as a whole. Like, and this guy writes about countries as a whole, right? But within countries, there are classes. There are classes burning more energy, using more energy, that are that all of the value and the growth goes to. I suppose I should end with that, but I'm mentioning it now. I won't have to later. Okay, Volkov's answer to, you know, is this a summary that growth is now not providing a return on investment? He says, yes, I think so. Without a biosphere in a good shape, there is no life on the planet. It's very simple. That's all you need to know. The economists will tell you that we can decouple growth from material consumption, but that is total nonsense. The options are quite clear from historical evidence. If you don't manage decline, then you succumb to it, and you're gone. The best hope is that you find some way to manage it. We are in a better position to do that now than we were 50 or 100 years ago, because our knowledge is much vaster. If we sit down, we can come up with something. It won't be painless, but we can come up with ways to minimize that pain. So he asks, so we need to change our expectations of GDP growth. Volkov says, and again, just framing everything as GDP growth, right? Now that we could have other economic indicators, which are other conversations that are happening, even on, God, I heard these conversations years ago. It's what, you know, got me thinking differently. But these guys are still on GDP. Like, they're still just talking about GDP. Why? Why haven't they moved on, like, with the rest of the interviews that I heard on NPR back in 2010? God, a whole decade ago. So he answers, yes, the simple fact is that however you define happiness, we know, and we have known this for ages, that the amount of GDP is not going to improve your satisfaction with life, which is the case I'm referring to. So I guess they have moved on, but this interviewer still asks about GDP. It shouldn't. It should just be disregarded. Okay, it says that the amount of GDP is not going to improve your satisfaction with life or sense of well-being. Look at Japan. They are pretty rich, but they are among the unhappiest people on the planet. Then who is always at the top 10% of happiest people? It's in the Philippines, which is much poorer, but smitten by typhoons, yet many times more happy than their neighbors in Japan. Once you reach a certain point, the benefits of GDP growth start to level off in terms of mortality, nutrition, and education. Now, on a personal level, there have been studies that once you hit an income of 70,000, happiness doesn't go up either. Is that point the golden medium? Is that what we should be aiming for rather than pushing until growth becomes malign, cancerous, obese, and environmentally destructive? Asks Watts. Exactly. That would be nice. We could have all energy and material consumption, and this would put us back around the level of the 60s. We could cut down without losing anything important. Life wasn't horrible in the 60s or 70s. People from Copenhagen would no longer be able to fly to Singapore for a 3-day visit, But so what? Not much is going to happen to their lives. People don't realize how much slack in the system we have. Again, by people, referring to well-off people. Watts asks, you cite Kenneth Boulding's distinction between the cowboy economy and the spaceman economy. The former is wide open spaces and seemingly endless opportunities for resource consumption. The latter is a recognition that planet Earth is more like a closed spaceship on which we need to carefully manage our resources. The challenge is to shift from one way of thinking to another. But human history is thousands of years of cowboys and only a few decades of spacemen. Aren't we hardwired? Is there any alternative to capitalism? And The Guardian is left-leaning, so it's weird that this interviewer talks this way. Okay, Volkow responds, there is a deep tradition both in the Eastern and Western traditions of frugality, living within your means, and a contemplative life. So he's basically dispelling this question with this hardwired cowboy economy. Yes, hundreds of years old, but that's exactly how long it's existed. It did not exist before that. It's purely a product of a European Renaissance and that Protestant Reformation mentioned. Now there is a louder voice calling for more consumption and a bigger bathroom and an SUV, but it's increasingly apparent that cannot go on. It will be something like smoking, which was everywhere 50 years ago, but now that people realize the clear link to lung cancer, restricted. The same will happen when people realize where material growth is taking us. It is a matter of time. Watts asks, how do we move in that direction before the risks become unmanageable? He gives an answer. To answer this, it's important to talk, not to talk in global terms. Okay. There will be many approaches which, so the opposite of what Zizek was doing. There are many approaches which have been tailored and targeted to each different audience. There's this pernicious idea by this Friedman guy, Thomas Friedman, that the world is flat and that everything is now the same, so that what works in one place can work for everyone. But that's totally wrong. For example, Denmark has nothing in common with Nigeria. What you do in each place will be different. What we need in Nigeria is more food, more growth. In the Philippines, we need a little more of it. And in Canada and Sweden, we need less of it. We have to look at what from different points of view. In some places, we have to foster what economists call degrowth. In other places, we have to foster growth. So again, he's using stats, and stats are provided by nation states, so he has to think in terms of nation states, countries, you know, country by country level, not cultural by culture level. And, you know, because you got people in different places in the world, but if they have the same kind of culture, like say they're both goth, you know, like they have more in common with each other. And yes, that's a subculture, but let's say the culture I'm talking about is being a leftist. In that case, way more in common. Your one-man statistical analysis is like the entire output of the World Bank, says Watts. Did this research make you feel we are closer to the end of growth than you previously realized? People ask me if I'm an optimist or a pessimist, and I say neither. I am not trying to be deliberately agnostic. This is the best conclusion I can come up with. In China, I've told people how bad the environment was, and the picture totally shocked people. They said, when will it collapse? And I'd answer, it's collapsing every day, but it's also being fixed every day. They used to be more coal and got more air pollution, but they also took billions from the World Bank and finally have modern water treatment in big cities. Now they are using modern farming, so there is less water. So they use less water for irrigation. This is how it is. This is how kind of species we are. We are stupid, negligent, tardy. But on the other hand, we are adaptable. We are smart. And even if things are falling apart, we are trying to stitch them together. But the most difficult thing is to calculate the net effect. Are we up or down? For all the analysis, we don't know this. Another thing about information flooding. Your book notes that the entire Library of Rome, 2,000 years ago, contained about 3 gigabytes of information, but now the global internet has more than a trillion times more. You're clearly skeptical that this is a net positive, or that this has improved our ability to deal with problems. Because that's the only way to look at things, right? I say, sarcastically. The growth of information is not just a flood or an explosion. Those adjectives are inadequate. We are buried under information. Now, I find it interesting as the people who catalog information and write books using global information chains that kind of say how buried we are. But they're the ones that are making a livelihood and expanding human thinking and consciousness with it. So I find it interesting. Yeah, there's a contradiction there. There are satellites above us producing huge amounts of information, but there are not enough people to analyze it. Yes, computers can help and shrink the amount, but someone still has to make decisions. There's too much to grasp. That assumes you have to make decisions based on all the data, or all the data is good for making decisions. Did you experience any statagasms, a statistical orgasm, in the course of your research? I'm a biologist by training, he says, so I was delighted to read new studies about the world's biggest trees, the redwoods and eucalyptus. They never stop growing, and for elephants, they have indeterminate patterns of growth and never really stop growing until they die. We humans stop when we are 18 or 19, but the biggest species on the planet keep on growing until they die. Fun fact. And on the human population? So again, just aggregate populations. What is most remarkable is how rapid the decline has been. For more than 100 years, the growth rate accelerated. The 30s faster than the 20s, the 40s faster than the 30s, and so on. By the 60s, the world population was growing so fast that a famous paper in Science said that by a few years in our time, present, it would be growing at an infinite rate, like a population singularity moment, which is, of course, absurd. Since then, the rate has declined every year. That's the rate of growth, not the population itself. Population continues to grow in absolute terms, but in percentage terms, it has been declining since the mid-60s. So to add on to that, again, speaking in terms of country by country, which I think is a problem. Let's see. Watts asks, overall, I would say the tone of the book is pessimistic, but you also mentioned the possibility of more optimistic scenario, in which the population globally does not expand beyond 9 billion. Now, again, a problem with this, side note, is that our consumption and resource use is dependent on what the population is. But to remind you, a majority of resource use is done by a minute minority of the population, you know, the 1%, or the 1% of the 1%. It's unequal. It's not flat at all. So that's why even talking about like just like the gross population and energy needs. I mean, I will remind you to keep in mind that, say, city skylines, the skylines of cities, you know, all the lights are on in the buildings, but a lot of them are office towers. Why are all the lights on? If you ask the owners of the building, it's because it looks pretty. It's an advertisement of a building. They keep the lights on. For that reason. And there's all the lights in parking lots, and that's just electricity. Of course, there's energy use all over the place that's totally wasteful. Okay. Given already apparent strains on the climate, how can we overcome or get over this dangerous bulge in population? Well, that's the difficult part. In the Western world, in Japan, we're almost there. China still has a way to go. It's just talking about the population leveling out. So he talks about energy use. Oh, and also talking about everyone kind of their energy use kind of getting to the same point as the U.S., you know, even though we are talking about degrowth. Is aging Japan a model? It strikes me as incredible that the country has been able to weather a long decline of property prices, stock market values, and population vitality and influence without sliding into chaos. Are there lessons there for others who face involuntary retreat? Now, I saw a really cute video about a city in Japan that started having some more socially positive policies that were pro-family. And wouldn't you know it, more people had kids. So in Japan, there's a crisis on if people are having kids. Why? Could it be because there's actually no social support? So as soon as this town started doing some social support, like having some daycares, especially they funded daycares at the train station so the parents can drop their kids off on their way to work. And boom, they attracted families. Japan can only be a partial model because until recently, it was such a frugal and disciplined society that people there can tolerate what others would not accept. But we have slack. So, and that, you know, by slack, he means waste and inequality. We are so fat in terms of material consumption. There is room to cut back, and there is no easy answer. If there were, we have already done it. Can businessmen accept an end to growth? Have you mentioned this to Bill Gates, your biggest fan? I don't need to tell him. He knows a lot about the environment. Put aside the billions of dollars, and he's just a guy who likes to understand the world. He reads dozens of books every year, like me. So that's the end of the interview. And I just want to repeat that with my own little quip. It's like, you know, put aside his billions of dollars. You know, I'd like to take Bill Gates' billions of dollars. And if you did, he's just a normal guy. You know, just another nerd like me. But with billions of dollars. Fancy that. Okay. So his book again, from Valkov Smil, his Growth from Microorganisms to Megacities. So I just talked about, you know, how growth needs to end from the perspective of a data nerd. Now for an article, it does a few things. One, it describes what degrowing the economy looks like. This is from a journal called The Conversation, Academic Rigor, Journalistic Flair, in the Environment and Energy section, titled Life in a Degrowth Economy and Why You Might Actually Enjoy It, published beginning of this month by Samuel Alexander, a research fellow in Melbourne. That's Australia. Now, the other thing this article does, which I find really interesting as I was reading it, is, so there are many YouTube videos, usually about the alt-right, about Nazi buzzwords or dog whistles that, in the language of, say, President Trump, right-wingers in the Senate, or, say, even Democratic candidates, there are various dog whistles, meaning words and language that have a ideological content behind them that can mean different things to certain people, meaning a certain thing. So a word or a phrase that may sound vague to a mainstream person or someone who doesn't have that specific viewpoint, but to that specific person, the word or the phrase means something more exact. Plenty of videos on like what a right-wing dog whistle is, but I'm going to put it repurpose that there are in fact also left-wing dog whistles. Now the right wing is probably always haranguing about these, but usually they're wrong, as in what is a dog whistle for what. So like whenever the word diversity is used, that's a dog whistle for killing white people. That would be what neo-Nazis say. But for me, there are dog whistles for the left. So this article here, when I was reading it, I actually didn't know what the content of it would be, of course. Hadn't read it yet. But as I was reading it, I was like, oh, he's actually using a bunch of phrases that, to me, refer to my ideology of eco-socialism and, you know, being commie and anarchist stuff. But he's putting it in an article that is, again, more academic for this particular context, this site, The Conversation, so that people who aren't leftists can read it and digest it and maybe understand it. But if you're a left-winger, it's hitting these points. What am I talking about? So let's dive in, and I'll point out when he's using something that is, to me, a dog whistle. But it can still be very informative on its face. So life in a degrowth economy. First, the question that wasn't asked in the last article. What does genuine economic progress look like? The orthodox answer is that a bigger economy is always better. But this idea is increasingly strained by the knowledge that on a finite planet, the economy can't grow forever. This week's Addicted to Growth conference in Sydney is exploring how to move beyond growth economics and towards a steady-state economy. But what is a steady-state economy? Why is it desirable or necessary? And what would it be like to live in? So right off the bat in the first paragraph, he starts with steady-state economy, which to me, well, it's not really about to me, but what I know about it is that it's a specific policy agenda that, when I started reading about it like a decade ago, was very, very niche,
and likely still is. But obviously, as things progress, it's probably a lot more acceptable to talk about now. So, the global predicament. We used to live on a planet that was relatively empty of humans. Today is full to overflowing, which is kind of a misnomer, but with more people consuming more resources, we would need 1.5 Earths to sustain the existing economy into the future. Every year this ecological overshoot continues, the foundations of our existence and that other species are undermined. So as I'm reading this, I'm thinking, like, where is this guy really coming from? He's kind of sounding almost eugenics-y too, or at least he's using the same language of the flat Earth that's like, I'm just going to take everything all together, ignore inequality, ignore class, ignore exploitation, hell, ignore capitalism. You know, talking about the steady state economy seems to ignore that we would need, it is a different economic system, but it seems to ignore that we would need to end capitalism because capitalism does in fact depend on growth. So if we were to have a non-growth economy, it would also need to be a socialist one. But that's my conclusion. Does this guy do as well? Let's explore. Now, at the same time, there are great multitudes around the world who are, by any humane standard, under-consuming, and the humanitarian challenge of eliminating global poverty is likely to increase the burden on ecosystems still further. Or we could take Bill Gates' billions away from him and then actually directly invest them in communities instead of just giving them bug nets and, you know, whatever maximizes the harm reduction. Meanwhile, the population is set to hit 11 billion this century. Despite this, the richest nations still seek to grow their economies without any limit. Like a snake eating its own tail, and I have a big problem. So the snake eating its own tail is the Ouroboros. A mythical creature, or is a symbol. But let me finish the paragraph first. Okay. Like a snake eating its own tail, our growth-oriented civilization suffers from the delusion that there is no environmental limits to growth. But rethinking growth in an age of limits cannot be avoided. The only question is whether it will be by design or disaster. Okay? Same thing I was talking about before. So as I was reading this, I was like, okay, this is still like, this is just like the old guys talking from my last article. And he uses the Ouroboros, the snake eating its own tail, as a wrong metaphor, which I guess most Americans do. So it, as a symbol, the Ouroboros is a symbol of the cycles of life, that it, you know, it doesn't have an end. It represents the worldview that, you know, in the past, that everything's made of cycles, that there is no progress that you really any make because everything grows, but it also dies. That there's a cycle to life, things reset, you know, the phoenix, instead of the always fragile, precarious economy that has to be micromanaged. So, next part, degrowth to a steady state economy. The idea of a steady state economy presents us with an alternative. An alternative to capitalism? I don't know. Let's see. But it's an alternative to our current state of things, right? Status quo. This term is somewhat misleading. However, because it suggests that we simply need to maintain the size of our existing economy and stop seeking further growth. But given the extent of ecological overshoot that we currently are doing, and bearing in mind that the poorest nations still need some room to develop their economies and allow the poorest billions to obtain some dignified level of existence, the transition will require the richest nations to downscale radically their current consumption. This realization has given rise to calls for economic degrowth. To be distinguished from recession, degrowth means a phase of planned and equitable economic contraction in the richest nations, eventually reaching a steady state that operates within Earth's biophysical limits. So again, I'm reading this like, is he ignoring that we have a billionaire class that just needs to be taxed and we need worker and citizen-owned economies instead of basically a minority owning the economy? At this point, mainstream economists will accuse degrowth advocates of misunderstanding the potential of technology, markets, and efficiency gains to decouple economic growth from environmental impact. This critique has already been mentioned this episode. It bears repeating. there is overlap between all the pieces I'm reading, but they're all kind of saying, coming at things differently as well, which is that there's some kind of consensus and convergence about these things. But our ruling class and the Democratic candidates in the primary debates aren't mentioning it all. Not part of the conversation at all. Everyone knows that we could produce and consume more efficiently than we do today. The problem is that efficiency without sufficiency is lost. Despite decades of extraordinarily technological advancement and huge improvement, you know, in economic efficiency, the energy and resource demands of the global economy are still increasing. The incentives are for it. This is because without a growth-oriented economy, efficiency gains tend to be reinvested in more consumption and more growth rather than in reducing impact. So a simple example that I encountered a long time ago, but still remember, is that of efficiency, overconsumption, and like, so let's say you have a housewife. It's in the it was talking about like the 50s and how all of these electronic appliances are labor-saving devices that it would mean less work, more leisure time. So let's say a vacuum that now it takes you half the time to vacuum your house with this new and improved vacuum. What ended up happening in practice is that the homemakers left with little else to do with their time and not expected to do more ended up just vacuuming twice as much. Or, as was also the case with, say, the feminine mystique and, you know, the 50s, at least when it comes to middle-class women, that all that time alone, they had time to actually reflect on how unfair it was that they didn't have a life of their own. Back to the task at hand. This is the defining critical flaw in growth economics, the false assumption that all economies across the globe can continue growing while radically reducing its impact. Greenwashing. As he says, the extent of decoupling required is simply too great. As we try unsuccessfully to a green capitalism, we see the face of Gaia vanishing. So he actually mentions the word capitalism, which, if you've noticed, all the other articles I've read haven't. So he starts kind of, this writing starts ebbing into, well, you know, let's go. I'm running out of time. The very lifestyles that were once considered the definition of success are now proving to be our greatest failure. Attempting to universalize affluence would be catastrophic. There is absolutely no way that today's 7 billion people could live the Western way of life, let alone the 11 billion expected in the future. Genuine progress now lies beyond growth. Tinkering around the edges of capitalism will not cut it. We need an alternative. So tinkering around the edges of capitalism is, to me, a buzzword for transformational, more revolutionary change. Now, revolutionary rhetoric is not implied, but it's, to me, it is, because you don't get that transformational change without big change. I remember a quote where, I don't know if it's Lenin or not, but it goes like, there are many decades where nothing happens, and then there's a few days where decades happen. And that's kind of how it feels with neoliberalism, that we've had decades of things getting worse, but also staying the same, but also getting a little better in other areas. Stasis. But then there'll be a year. Don't know what year it'll be. A lot will happen all at once. And it feels like a lot's happening right now. But it's still very much, at least for us in America, everything is still the same. We have an election next year, and we have primary debates. It all seems very business as usual. And people have the same kind of arguments they were having a decade ago, 20 years ago. I mean, I have friends of mine, love them, they're friends. But they're giving me, you know, I'm Green Party, and they give me arguments against the Green Party like the same arguments from 20 years ago. The argument hasn't changed, despite the context, and I would say our successes. You know, the Green New Deal came from us. Now half the Democratic primary candidates are using the term. Now, it's different policy, but as far as, like, the viewpoint and the kind of the milieu of it, it's they're working off of, they're cribbing off of us. We, the Green Party, have pulled the Dems left. Now, Bernie Sanders has been caucusing with the Dems for decades. I'm not really confident in the argument that Bernie Sanders and other soap Dems pull the Dems left, right? They're kind of doing their own thing, and they're not really pulling the rest of the Dems with them. The Dems go left when there's an outside force threatening their monopoly or threatening their success. Whether it's we're helping reactionaries or not, we're hurting the Dems. And when they're hurting, then they actually have to change. Okay, totally getting off topic. Sorry. But it was on my mind. Enough for everyone, forever. When one first hears calls for degrowth, it is easy to think that this new economic vision must be about hardship, deprivation, yes. That it means going back to the Stone Age or restricting ourselves to a stagnant culture, you know, primitivism, or being anti-progress. This is not so. Degrowth would liberate us from the burden of pursuing material access. We simply don't need so much stuff. Certainly not if it comes at the cost of planetary health, social justice, and personal well-being. He mentions the word social justice. Dog whistle number two. Consumerism is a gross failure of imagination, a debilitating addiction that degrades nature and doesn't even satisfy the universal human craving for meaning. So those are things not mentioned in previous articles either. Or by the other, you know, we need to stop growth, guys. But still talking about it in a very status quo kind of way. But this guy is not for the status quo, and that's what I mean by, like, the dog whistles, the things he's saying that signal to me that he's way more radical than he may have, like, as he started writing. Degrowth, by contrast, would involve embracing, or maybe I'm just crazy. Maybe I'm just reading into it. Degrowth, by contrast, would involve embracing what has been termed the simpler way, producing and consuming less. This would be a way of life based on a modest material and energy needs, but nonetheless rich in other dimensions. A life of frugal abundance. It is about creating an economy based on sufficiency, knowing how much is enough to live well, and discovering that enough is plenty. The lifestyle implications of degrowth and sufficiency are far more radical than the light green forms of sustainable consumption that are widely discussed today. You know, eating organic food and the other distractions that Zizek pointed out. Turning off the lights, taking shorter showers, and recycling are all necessary parts of what sustainability will require of us, but these measures are far from enough. I'm going to quote Tree Hugger, which is another kind of environmental blog, that a waster with a gizmo is still a waster. Referring to, you know, a gizmo or a gadget that you buy to help you take shorter showers, or, you know, apps on your phone to help you, you know, be more green. These are gizmos, and you're still a waster even if you're using a gizmo. But this does not mean we must live a life of painful sacrifice. Most of our basic needs can be met in simple and low-impact ways while maintaining a high quality of life. I would also add on that includes eating the rich. In a degrowth society, we would aspire to localize our... Okay, so what would life in a degrowth society look like? Okay, my last 10 minutes. So here's where... Okay, I'm going to, like, ding or, like, just point out every time he kind of... As he describes what degrowth society would look like. Because there's the steady-state economics people, and they're pretty vague. But this guy is not vague. Okay. In fact, his prescriptions are my political agenda. In a degrowth society, we would aspire to localize our economies as far and appropriately as possible. This would assist with reducing carbon-intensive global trade, while also rebuilding resilience in the face of uncertain and turbulent future. Going back to that anthropologist's point. Through forms of direct and participatory democracy, we would organize our economies to ensure that everyone's basic needs are met, and then redirect our energies away from economic expansion. This would be a relatively low energy model of living that ran primarily on renewable energy. But this renewable energy cannot sustain
the energy-intensive global society of high-end consumers. A degrowth society embraces the necessity of an energy descent, turning our energy crisis into an opportunity for a civilizational renewal. We would tend to reduce our working hours in a formal economy in exchange for more home production and leisure. We would have less income but more freedom. Thus, in our simplicity, we would be rich. Whenever possible, we would grow our own organic food, water our gardens with water tanks, and turn our neighborhoods into edible landscapes as the Cubans have done in Havana. As my friend Adam Grubb so delightfully declares, we should eat the suburbs. Dog whistle. So he doesn't say eat the rich, he says eat the suburbs, but might as well be saying that. While supplementing urban agriculture with food from local farmers' markets. And he also references things the Cubans are doing. So he's also not playing into the, if it's under a communist state or if it's involved with a communist state or socialist state, it's bad. So he's throwing that out. Let's say we do not need to purchase as many new clothes. Let us amend or exchange our clothes. We can become radical recyclers and do-it-yourself experts. This would partly be driven by the fact that we would simply be living in an era of relative scarcity. But human beings find creative projects fulfilling in the challenge of building a new world within the shell of the old. Building a new world in the shell of the old. That's a Occupy/anarchist slogan. To be immensely meaningful, even if it only entails times of trial. The apparent scarcity of goods can also be greatly reduced by scaling up the sharing economy. A real one, not the app one, to enrich our communities. One day we might even live in cob houses that we build ourselves, but over the next few critical decades, the fact is that most of us will be living within a poorly designed urban infrastructure that already exists. We are hardly going to knock it all down and start again. Instead, we must retrofit the suburbs. As leading permaculturalist, mentioning permaculture, David Horrigan argues. Now, permaculture, by its adherents, say that it is a revolution disguised as gardening. I'd also say that permaculture without class consciousness is, or class struggle, is mere gardening. This would involve doing everything we can to make our homes more energy efficient, more productive, etc. More densely inhabited. So it's not about building taller, which is energy and materially intensive, but just having more three-story, two-story, but closer together, more dense. It's possible. In fact, it's very much the case. This is not the eco-future that we are shown in glossy design magazines featuring million-dollar green homes that are prohibitively expensive. And that's most of the books on my library shelf, by the way, about like green or sustainable design. The houses are, you know, $500,000 at least. It's not something I could build on a budget. But there are green and micro houses that can be built on a budget, a few thousand dollars. Anyway, making the change. A degrowth transition to a steady state economy could happen in a variety of ways. But the nature of this alternative vision suggests that the changes will need to be driven from the bottom up rather than imposed from the top down. So that's in contrast to that draconian thing mentioned by the New Yorker writer, as well as the the communism of a one world government of cooperation. But cooperation also implies democracy and being bottom up. What I've written above highlights a few of the personal and household aspects of a degrowth society based on sufficiency. It mentions transition towns, which is a kind of movement where whole communities can then engage with this idea. But it is critical to acknowledge the social and structural constraints that currently make it much more difficult. Now, transition towns, by the way, came up during the kind of quote-unquote peak oil, and it was mostly just addressed on transitioning away from fossil fuels, not capitalism. But there's a lot of overlap between those two things. The more you want to, say, be independent of a certain sector of the corporate economy, the more post-capitalist you're going to be. Like, you just kind of have to face up and own up that if you want to be independent or self-sufficient in any way or free of corporate control and dominance, you just got to be an anti-capitalist. Like, you have to be fighting for not capitalism. Which, yes, is for the most part
socialism of some type. Because all these things here, to me, as an eco-socialist, are dog whistles. He's explaining and describing to me to eco-socialism. Just without dependence on the state. You know, none of the things he's talking about depend on the state. State power. Because nation states, they're on the way out. Okay, I only have a minute left. But I've also reached the end. And he ends with a quip, which I like saying myself. The alternative is to consume ourselves to death under the false banner of green growth, which is just not smart economics. Which also dovetails with the motto of like the rhetoric of about smart cities. Well, smart cities make for dumb citizens. And oh, and also the misnomer of smart growth. So yeah, we just need smarter growth. We can keep growing. Bull. Okay. So in the last minute, I'm going to do my housekeeping. Remind you that you've been listening to the Three Left Show. Three Left stand for different ideologies in my multi-tenancy perspective. I'm Dan Platt. I'm on social media at The Three Left Show on Twitter and Facebook. Facebook page, I post all episodes of the podcast version, which is an edited form of this. It's on all the podcast apps, including Spotify now. I have a Patreon page. If you'd like to materially support me so I can spend more time on this, do live streams online on via YouTube, because I am also on YouTube, but I don't post. There's not there, so I don't promote it. But that is also The Three Left Show. At threelefts.news, that is the website where you can find a full archive of all episodes. So, thank you very much for joining me. Be well.